जय गोपी जन पाल पर चारी जय गोपी जन पाल पर चारी यशोदनन्दन व्रजजनरञ्जन यशोदनन्दन व्रजजनरञ्जन यमुनातीरवनचारी यमुनातीरवनचारी जय राजा माधव कुञ्जबिहारी जय राजा माधव कुञ्जबिहारी जय
ग्रंथराश्मं भागवतं की
जय
ताई गौर प्रेमनंदि
हरि बोल
ओ ग्लोरियस टू द
टेंपल हरे कृष्ण This morning we reading from Canto 7, chapter 10, text 51, although I've been assigned text 51 through 59. This one has a very brief purport, and then in the next purport that appears is in text 59. So I'll just begin. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Vatale Sramataram Padaswami Tinamani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nivashe Sunyavadi Paschitya Deshatarine Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Vatale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nivashe Sunyavadi Paschitya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. So text 51. Sa eva Bhagavan Rajan. Vyatanat Vihatam Yashaha. Pura Rudrasya Devasya. Mayena nanta mayena sa esha bhagavan rajan yatanod vihatam yashaha Pura Rudrasya Devasya Mayenan Ta Mayina. Please chant. Saisha Bhagavan Rajan. Pararujasya Devasya. Mayananta Mayana. The word for word translation. Saisha Bhagavan. The same personality of Godhead Krishna, who is Parabrahman. Rajan, my dear king, Vyata not expanded, Vihatam lost, Yashaha reputation, Para, formerly in history, Rudrasya, of Lord Shiva, the most powerful among the demigods, Devasya, the demigod, Mayena, by a demon named Maya, Ananta, unlimited, Maya, Mayina, possessing technical knowledge. The translation, my dear King Yudhisthira, long, long ago in history, a demon known as Maya Danava, who was very expert in technical knowledge, reduced the reputation of Lord Shiva. In that situation, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, saved Lord Shiva. And the purport. Lord Shiva is known as Mahadev, the most exalted demigod. Thus, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that although Lord Brahma did not know the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Shiva could have known them. This historical incident proves that Lord Shiva derives power from Lord Krishna, the Parabrahman. So I'll read the all the way through to text 59, since that is what is assigned for today. And I'm actually going to put a focus on text 59, since it has, it seems to kind of encapsulate what's transpired through the purport. So text 52, I guess I'll just read the translations. Maharaj Yudhisthira said, for what reason did the demon Maya, Danava, vanquish Lord Shiva's reputation? How did Lord Krishna, Save Lord Shiva and expand his reputation again. Kindly describe these incidents. Text 54 to 55. Narada Muni said, when the demigods, who are always powerful, by the mercy of Lord Krishna, fought with the Asuras were defeated, and therefore they took shelter of Maya Dhanava, the greatest of the demons. Next text. Maya Dhanava, the great leader of the demons, prepared three invisible residences and gave them to the demons. These dwellings resembled airplanes made of gold, silver, and iron, and they contained uncommon paraphernalia. My dear King Yudhisthira, because of these three dwellings, the commanders of the demons remained invisible to the demigods. Taking advantage of this opportunity, the demons, remembering their former enmity, began to vanquish the three worlds, the upper, middle, and lower planetary system. So text 56, translation. Thereafter, when the demons had begun to destroy the higher planetary systems, the rulers of those planets went to Lord Shiva, fully surrendered unto him, and said, dear Lord, we demigods living in the three worlds are about to be vanquished. We are your followers. Kindly save us. Text 57, translation. The most powerful and able Lord Shiva reassured them and said, do not be afraid. He then fixed his arrows to his bow and released them towards the three residences occupied by the demons. Text 58. Translation. The arrows released by Lord Shiva appeared like fiery fiery beams emanating from the sun globe and covered the three residential airplanes, which could then no longer be seen. And here's text 59, which I'm going to put a focus on. So this one I'll read both the Sanskrit and the translation. Rais Pursha Vyasa Vahasarve Nipetahasma Paran Kashaha Tan Aniya Kaha Yohi Mayaha Kupa Rase Shipat. So the translation of this is, attacked by Lord Shiva's golden arrows, all the demoniac inhabitants of those three dwellings lost their lives and fell down. Then the great mystic Maya Dhanava dropped the demons into a nectarian well that he had created. And the purport. The Asuras are generally extremely powerful because of their mystic yogic power. However, as Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 6:47, yoginam api sarvesham mad gate nantar atmanaha shradavan bhujate yomam same yuktatmanaha mataha. Of all the yogis, he who always abides in me with great faith, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. The actual purpose of mystic yoga is to concentrate one's attention fully on the personality of Godhead Krishna and always think of him. Sorry. That's Madgate Nantar. To obtain such perfection, one must undergo a certain process, Bhakti Hatha Yoga, And through this yoga system, the practitioner achieves some uncommon mystic power. The Asuras, however, instead of becoming devotees of Krishna, utilize this mystic power for their personal sense gratification. Maya Danva, for example, is mentioned here as Mahayogi, a great mystic. But his business was to help the Asuras. Nowadays, we are actually seeing that there are some yogis who cater to the senses of materialists. And they are imposters who advertise themselves as God. Maya Danava was such a person, a god amongst the demons, and he could perform some wonderful feats, one of which is described here. He made a well filled with nectar and dipped the Asuras into that nectarian well. The Asuras, that nectar was known as Mritya Sanjeeva Sitari, for it could bring a dead body to life. Mritya Sanjeevaitari is also known as an Ayurvedic preparation. It is a kind of liquor that invigorates even a person on the verge of death. So, quite an extensive narrative here. Okay. So, immediately in this narration, Srila Prabhupada is drawing our attention to the purpose of mystic yoga. And this is a very important focus in this particular set of verses, because we see the action of two great personalities, or at least we see the action of one great personality, and the other one we're going to come to, meaning Lord Shiva. So, this purpose that Srila Prabhupada's drawing our attention to is concentrating one's attention fully on the personality of Godhead and always thinking of him. And this from this particular verse that Srila Prabhupada is looking at in Bhagavad Gita, Mat Gate Nantar Atmanaha, which is translated as abiding in Krishna, always thinking of him. So actually, there's a definition that Srila Prabhupada gives of perfection. So there's mystic yoga is supposed to lead to some perfection. So abiding in Krishna and always thinking for him is actually the definition that Srila Prabhupada uses for perfection. So the yoga that allows for that perfection, that abiding in Krishna, always thinking of him, is bhakti yoga. And this verse, this Bhagavad Gita verse 647, actually gives an explanation of this highly praised form of yoga. Bhakti yoga is highly praised. And that explanation, well, I'll read the verse because it's so pivotal for explaining bhakti yoga. Yogi mam api sarvesham mat gate nantar atmana. Shradavan bhajate yomam same yuktamano mataha. And of all the yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. So it's actually an explanation of bhakti yoga, this verse. And Krishna says, that's my opinion. say his opinion obviously is the final say as far as things go on the process of yoga. So that explanation is that it's not mere worship. Like, you know, one can show respect. You know, through worship, you're showing some respect. Like, you might show respect towards a demigod. So it's not mere worship towards Krishna, but actually serving him. So it's a much, that's where that intimate aspect comes in. It's making a connection. One's performing some activity to that personality. It's connected. So, and there's a mood with which it's been done, with love and faith. So, and that is specifically meant for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not external, because respect can be external. One may see some personality that's written about, and one may feel respectful because one may have heard that that personality is a great philanthropist, and so one will feel respectful. But this is quite different. It's actually going much closer. You're directly serving, performing some action for that great personality. And I think yesterday we heard a very fantastic analogy being made on this point of how one is actually getting closer and closer and closer to a great personality. And so this verse is actually that closeness, that intimacy, directly serving. So now, in this particular purport that I read from, text 59, Srila Prabhupada is referring to Maya Dhanava as a Mahayogi or a mystic. Now, it's just by way of putting this into perspective, I'm going to go to the previous verse in Bhagavad Gita, to this one that, you know, so nicely actually explains Bhakti Yoga, where actually Krishna makes a comparison. It's a comparison between a yogi and various other personalities that are performing different austerities. So he says, this is Krishna's statement, a yogi is greater than an ascetic, is greater than an empiricist, and is greater than the fruitive worker. So it's putting the position of the yogi in perspective. So, and he in fact advises Arjuna that in all circumstances be a yogi. So, since by definition, yoga is linking of our consciousness with the Supreme Absolute Truth. That's the definition of yoga. And since Bhakti Yoga is the most intimate linking with the Supreme Absolute Truth, because it brings us full knowledge, means of oneself in relation to Krishna, that's the purpose of yoga, you're going to get some understanding of that connection of oneself in relation to the Supreme Absolute Truth. So, we can understand that somebody who's an ascetic, that they're actually lacking self-knowledge, because they haven't actually, they can't possibly reach that same perfection that somebody who's making the intimate connection with Krishna through Bhakti Yoga is doing. The ascetic, whatever austerities are being performed, they haven't made that connection. There's no connection being made. So the yogic connection, the connection with the Supreme Personality of God is not there. So they cannot reach perfection. And in the same way, the empiricist, they haven't included the aspect of surrender. So they don't have somebody that they're surrendering to, you know, based on their knowledge. They're always actually engaged in wrangling, moving knowledge around, but there's no concept of that there's a greater personality who has all the knowledge and that there's some relationship with that. So there's no aspect of surrender, so they cannot have any perfection. And also, you can't even, I mean, a fruitive worker really pales even in comparison to those two, the ascetic and the empiricist, because they completely, of course, also lack that link with Krishna. So you can see that already the yogi's been put on some platform. So I'm just backtracking. It then comes that verse in Bhagavad Gita where bhakti yoga is really given prominence, how through bhakti yoga you're making that intimate connection. So it's not merely, you know, connection with the Supreme Absolute Truth, but it's actually serving and with a particular mood. So it's really slowly elevating the position of bhakti yoga. So now it leads to an interesting question, because the personality that we're looking at here, Maya Dhanava, is a yogi. So the question, of course, is that a yogi is a transcendentalist. So by definition, it means that the consciousness has been linked with the Supreme. But here we're hearing about Maya Dhanava. So how is it that he takes the position of an imposter god? Because that's mentioned in the purport. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, how is it that a transcendentalist takes that position? So, and in fact, we get a little bit of information about him. He's described as the greatest of the demons and as one who provided shelter to the Asuras. So all the demons, he was the shelter for all the Asuras. So he's taken the position of the supreme, a kind of god amongst the demons. They came to him to take shelter of him. So, but, you know, we understand, because he's been categorized as demon, that clearly he can't be practicing bhakti yoga, because he's taking a position in competition to Krishna, an imposter god. So, so we're going to look a little bit contrasting the position of somebody who's connecting with Krishna through bhakti yoga, and then looking at Maya Dhanava's position to try and understand how this all fits together. So somebody who Krishna considers perfect. Now this is Krishna. He gives certain criteria for the perfect yogi. So these are Krishna's criteria for a perfect yogi. And it comes, I didn't put the reference, but anyway, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be the most perfect. So the criteria that Krishna gives for a yogi, or a perfect yogi, is that everything is done for him. I mean, everything has been done for Krishna. So there isn't a moment that's actually passing that yogi isn't devoting activities to Krishna. So that's Krishna's criterion of a perfect yogi. Always worshipping Krishna, and there's transcendental faith, and they're always engaged in that way. Always. That's the word, always. There's not a break in it. It's constant. So that's the perfect Krishna's criteria for the perfect yogi. now, it becomes clear when you think about that always aspect that a person has to be transcendentally situated in pure goodness to be engaged in such worship. Now, what is meant by that is that the person is no longer identifying the body with the soul, because that's a common confusion. It's no longer that problem. And this made me think about, okay, let's move to looking at Lord Shiva, because he's the other great personality in this narrative that's going to emerge. And the question asked by Maharaj Yudhisthira is looking at how Lord Shiva had this interaction with this great demon and how it all transpired. And we've just read something of the activities of the demon, but I'm going to move us a little bit to what Lord Shiva says about himself regarding his worship or his God worship. This is Lord Shiva assessing himself and how he functions. So he says, I am always engaged in offering obeisances to Lord Vasudev in pure Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is always pure consciousness in which the Supreme Personality of Godhead, known as Vasudev, is revealed without any covering. So this is from Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto, third verse, and the 23rd verse. So this is Lord Shiva talking about himself. So what becomes clear is that Lord Shiva is existing in a state which is transcendental to material qualities. It means all the activities of material consciousness have stopped. We can understand this from Lord Shiva's statement of how he's functioning in pure Krishna consciousness. So Lord Shiva describes that he's existing in a state in which the senses can see Krishna without any covering. So this, from our knowing the analogy given by Lord Chaitanya, it means that for Lord Shiva, the mirror of his mind has become completely cleansed. And so he has a very clear concept of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Very interesting, because he himself describes what he's understanding and seeing. So, and this is connected to this particular verse, because in the purport to this verse, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he actually tells us that Lord Shiva could have known the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it ties in very nicely. Lord Shiva's statement about his own worship and Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur adding a comment. So moving away from that, we look at Maya Dhanava. It has a complete contrast. It's a demoniac entity. And generally, a demoniac entity is described as not having knowledge of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of God, which may appear like an obvious statement, but remember, he's been called a great mystic. So, but still, he falls into the category of demons, so he actually doesn't have knowledge of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Srila Prabhupada mentions that the particular yogic process that somebody like Maya Dhanava has gone through to achieve perfection was Hatha Yoga. So this is very interesting because this is a yoga system which gives some uncommon mystic power. And usually it's described, Hatha Yoga is described as having 8 limbs. There are asanas, there are pranayam, the breathing, there are mudras, the gestures, and meditation. So, so in keeping with the physical aspect of Hatha Yoga, or the techniques of it, there of course are certain benefits that come, and I have to use the words. I wasn't familiar with this until I started looking at this particular demon's position. But the effects of Hatha Yoga are the following, and we don't usually hear this in advertisements of Hatha Yoga practices in yoga studios, but here they are. There's kala vanchana, which is cheating death. There's utkranti, which is a kind of yogic suicide, and parakaya pravesha, which is entering another body. So these are actually some of the perfections that can be present if one's practicing Hatha Yoga, or one can achieve those. So we can see here actually a very nice illustration of exactly this, because Amaya Dhanava, he practiced this Kalvanchana because he created a well with nectar which could infuse life into those demons that had been vanquished by Lord Shiva's arrows. So there's that particular perfection, being able to cheat death. Maya Dhanava illustrates it perfectly. It's obviously a great personality. I mean, we don't find generally somebody who's gone through Hatha Yoga in a yoga studio has come to this point. It's a particular siddhi, that's a perfection that's there. Now, in the Yoga Sutras of Paranjali, there's liberation is actually the pursuit of Hatha Yoga. And these are just siddhis or perfections that get taught along the way. But because we understand that a demon is not making the connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, actually the emphasis has rather been on the siddhis. You know, the perfections that come with the practice of that yoga. So he is called a great mystic. He's attained these perfections. But Krishna's description of such a personality, because he's classified as a demon, is that such entities, Krishna's description is that they're lost to themselves. The self has to have made that connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If there's not that connection, lost to themselves. The self is not known, it's lost. So that's actually the position of Maya Dhanava. Great yogi, but emphasis on the siddhis, lost to themselves. And generally, and this is Krishna's description of the demons in Bhagavad Gita 16:9, he says they are engaged in works that are unbeneficial and horrible, and are meant to destroy the world. So you don't usually think that a yogi is doing that, but Maya Dhanava, we see that he was actually creating these mystic dwelling places, these airplanes made of gold and silver and iron. You don't usually think of a heavy airplane iron, but so he did these heavy metals. And within these airplanes, the commanders of the demons were able to reside. And on top of it, even though they had these incredible metals, they were invisible. So great mystic yogi. But what was the purpose of that? It tells you, demoniac. As soon as those commanders of the demons are there, they remember their ill feelings towards the demigods, and immediately they begin destruction. They start destroying things, you know, including attempting to destroy the upper planetary system where the demigods reside, Lord Shiva's abode, and that's when the demigods come to Lord Shiva, and we just read that particular narration through the verses. So I guess this particular section just drew my attention to the this contrast between the different yogic processes and how actually the perfection that comes from Bhakti Yoga differs so greatly from the perfection of a yogic system that is used by the practitioner in such a way that the emphasis is not on the connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's what emerged for me from reading this little section, which actually was highly narrative-like. So These are some thoughts, if there's anybody who would like to share a thought.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. You made a lot of nice points. One of them was, I think you said at the end of the class, that unless we're connected with Krishna, then we're lost to ourselves. And I'm not sure if you remember, Prabhupada said something to the extent that like the last snare of Maya is to think oneself God or something like that. The last snare of Maya is to think oneself God. And I think you made that earlier in your class when you said, when you were analyzing the different yogis, the fruitive worker, an ascetic, and Krishna says become a yogi. And I think the point you made was, unless we surrender to Krishna, then we're going to try to, by default, be God or something to that extent. I think those are some of the points I appreciated. So my question is related to that point in terms of trying to be God, like the supreme controller, especially trying to control your reputation, which this verse mentions. Because we could see from my personal experience in the material world, it's natural that it's hard to be humble. We try to save our reputation. If our reputations get slandered, naturally we want to, you know, save it. So, and we could see that in this instance that Lord Shiva's reputation, I guess they said, was being slandered by the demon, but Krishna saved his reputation. So my question is that as practicing devotees, how do we know from our personal perspective to distinguish between wanting respect and justice? Because suppose somebody slanders our reputation, that's something we have no control over, because somebody slanders our reputation, then another person slanders our reputation, then we're trying to defend it, you know, while wasting so much time when we could be, you know, engaging in Christian consciousness. So how do we know that if it's justice? Because sometimes we like to justify it, our actions as revenge. We like to justify revenge as justice. How do we know if it's just justice, real justice, or just wanting to, you know, save our reputation due to pride?
Okay. Yes, I didn't deal with in which way Lord Shiva's reputation got hurt, but I guess just by virtue of the fact that Maya Dhanva found a way to go around Lord Shiva's attempt to destroy the demons in the airplanes, those mystic airplanes, that even though the demons fell down, which this verse put an emphasis on, he found a way to actually resuscitate their lives. So that, I guess, I mean, it'll go on the narrative, but that would have been, I guess, a little... could appear to be a dent in Lord Shiva's reputation that he wasn't successful in preventing the Asuras from beginning their destructive work. So your question dealt with, like, on a personal level, if one is actually finding that persons are harming one's reputation in some way, maybe coming left, right, and center, and you know, how does one know if an action that one takes is a just action, or is it an action that is of a different kind? Yeah, just or not just. So, because we all have taken to the process of bhakti yoga, so our process is to connect with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the particular quote I read early on was that Krishna defines the bhakti yoga practitioner, or the whole process, of one of performing service to him. So, and with a particular mood, with love and faith, that, you know, one's going to reach that goal of becoming perfect in one's relationship with him. So taking that into mind, that is actually what we're doing. That is the process. We're on that path. So if we're on that path, our whole approach is that we're going to also treat others, particularly in the fellow bhakti yoga practitioners, we're also going to see them as persons that one respectfully looks at, because they also are engaged in the process of Bhakti Yoga. They're also trying to serve with great love the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's always a respectful mood to a fellow Bhakti Yoga practitioner, even if it appears that that person is in some way not understanding one, appears that that person is perhaps slighting one in some way, even if it appears that that person is somehow even harming one by saying ill words about one, even if it appears like that, one shouldn't change one's view that this is a person who's engaged in the process of Bhakti Yoga. I feel respectful because I understand this person is trying to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead with love. I mean, one just keeps that very strongly in one's mind. If one finds oneself feeling unhappy, however, because one is hearing or processing what one is hearing as somehow detrimental to oneself, or it's not in keeping with the image of one has of oneself, or it somehow is appearing to slight one in some way, even if it comes like that to oneself, it is better to go, rather than lose that respect for that person, because after all, one is responsible for how one is perceiving and processing. It is better to go to somebody that one has a good relationship with in that sangha of devotees, those that have taken to the process of Bhakti Yoga, and reveal one's mind, actually share, I am feeling slighted, or I feel my reputation has been harmed, even to take it broader, because I see myself in this way, but what I'm hearing here is not in accord with how I see myself. So open one's heart, reveal one's mind to somebody that one has a relationship with. And then one can actually hear in a more objective way, in this case, what I understand of this person who's also practicing Bhakti Yoga, this personality does things this and this way. This is this aspect of their character. In your case, what I know of you is this and this. You may have a sensitivity or whatever it is, but the person that's close to you will actually be able to give support and keep one grounded so that one doesn't get pulled away from the whole process of Bhakti Yoga because one's mind is getting disturbed because one is now thinking that one has been slighted or one's reputation has been harmed. So it's essential to go to a fellow practitioner that one trusts and reveal how one is feeling, but never change the mood of respect. And if it's getting hard and you're finding yourself veering towards disrespect, it's definitely a sign to go and open your heart to a fellow Bhakti Yoga practitioner.
Oh.
That's mentioned in Nectar of Instruction, revealing one's mind in confidence. It's one of the important little points in practicing Bhakti Yoga, very important.
On a separate note, I wanted just to just bring out the in terms of Lord Shiva's position, just, you know, highlight that his position is always perfect. In terms of his consciousness, he doesn't go from the process of necessarily cleansing his heart, but you know, from the very beginning, he's in a different space than other conditioned souls. So he's the only one in Shiva Tattva. So there's Vishnu Tattva, Shiva Tattva, and Jiva Tattva. So Lord Shiva is on his own space. So, yes.
Oh, thank you very much for adding that. Yes, actually, it was very beautiful to read that quote that I read to you where he's having a conversation with his wife, Sati, and he's describing actually where his consciousness is. And he says it's pure Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, it's not that he's a resident of Vaikuntha now, but he's acting in pure Krishna consciousness. So yes, he's very unique, his position. Thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you for your answer. That made things very clear for me. And so my other question is kind of on a flip side of the coin of that. And that's what I appreciate about the Acharyas. You know, any Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, all their prayers were essentially, because my question is it detrimental to our consciousness to always put on, or at least try to put on a perfect image? Because we could see that the Acharyas, they always wrote that, even though they weren't, they always wrote, I'm fallen, I'm lusty, I'm angry, I'm greedy, I'm envious, and then they were complete opposite. So that way, if somebody slanders their character, it's like, no big deal, because I already slandered my own character. So that's kind of one thing I appreciated about the Acharyas. And I meditated on this point in the Bhagavatam. One thing I appreciate about like Lord Brahma or Indra, even though they don't get like credit as much as, let's say, Prahlad or Haridas Thakur and other, you know, like perfect devotees. I was meditating on this point before, like we hear in the Bhagavatam that Indra made a lot of mistakes and he rectified himself, but he never told Vyasadeva to edit that out, edit his mistakes out the Srimad Bhagavatam. I want a perfect reputation. And we hear that Lord Brahma, like, he had sexual feelings for his daughter. That's kind of embarrassing, like, you know, edit out the Bhagavatam. We didn't hear that. So my question is basically is that, is it very detrimental, or maybe you could elaborate on it, is it detrimental to us to always try to put on a perfect reputation? We're essentially harming ourselves like that, essentially. So can you elaborate on that? Like, you know, if like putting on a perfect show.
Is one actually harming oneself if one is putting up a front of having a perfect reputation?
Yeah, and that makes one more have that desire for respect. And then when one doesn't receive it, then, you know, like in the Gita says, Kama Esha, Krodha Esha, Raja Guna Sambhu Bhavaha. If we have a desire and it's not fulfilled, we become angry. If we want respect and we don't get it, we become angry from trying to put on a perfect show. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Okay, so the question is, is it harmful to oneself to put up a front of having a perfect reputation? And if one is not receiving respect and becomes angry, how does that play into the whole equation? Well, I guess, you know, since Lord Brahma here was brought up in the purport to text 51, and a comparison was being made by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur between himself and Lord Shiva. And Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was saying that Lord Brahma didn't know all the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but Lord Shiva may have known them. So Lord Brahma, in his in that particular pastime where he actually wants to prove his supremacy over Krishna, so there's a pride component that enters. He actually goes through a very, what would be the word, a big change of consciousness when, to his surprise, he sees that the very cowherd boys and cows that he thought he had stashed away in a cave, he actually sees them continuing with their activities. So it becomes very clear to him the greatness of Lord Krishna. And then he actually says numerous prayers after that, glorifying Krishna's position. So this was, of course, orchestrated by Krishna, because Krishna is very kind to the personalities that are trying to serve him. So he brings into consciousness that particular aspect of one's personality, or the particular what one say, quality that's emerging in one's mind that's not conducive to the whole process of serving him. So in Lord Brahma's case, it was the pride factor. In one's own case, if it's becoming apparent that, you know, one is looking for respect and is, you know, a little bit angry because one's not getting it, then, you know, one should see it that it's actually a kindness on the part of Krishna that this has been revealed to one. It's such a kindness. One may have been oblivious that one was functioning that way. But thanks to the process, you know, that one is a bhakti yoga practitioner, one is attempting to serve Krishna, and Krishna says it's intimate. So the intimate response of Krishna is to reveal that to oneself. So it's a great blessing that it's been revealed to oneself. So rather than focusing on, yes, now let me look for all the circumstances in which this is shown to be the actual fact, you know, the respect is not being given. Rather than using that approach, which is a lot of energy wasted, because one is practicing bhakti yoga, one goes back and looks at the relationship with Krishna. So the relationship with Krishna is, oh, it's been revealed to me that right now I'm looking for respect. And I'm not getting it. Okay. One actually goes to Krishna humbly and is grateful that he's actually shown us this. Because it is, it's a blessing that's been given that one's been allowed to see that. So one prays that now that this has been revealed to me, let me somehow be able to go past this. Give me the intelligence for how I can actually stop putting my energy into this looking for respect. So one of the things that's advised generally is that you want, better to give it to others. So one may now be looking for respect. So it means that one may not fully be comfortable with feeling respected and comfortable with the whole concept of respect, but one can start to practice being respectful towards others. Because when you start practicing, you start to know what it looks like. And then automatically, one starts to feel that, yes, well, actually, I can feel respectful towards myself. And that's important. So start to practice that respect towards others. And the way to practice it is just reminding oneself, who are those people that one is associating with? I mean, they're persons that are trying to serve Krishna with great love. I mean, where do you find such persons? It's a small group, and what an extraordinary group of entities. So one tries to practice being respectful to them and showing respect in whatever little ways, you know, appreciating the different things that devotees do. You know, somebody has actually cooked this nicely for Krishna. Somebody has actually swept the altar nicely for Krishna. So little ways that one, you know, just trains one's mind to feel respectful for those activities that those persons are forming in their relationship with Krishna. And just through cultivating that, you know, appreciating every little thing that you notice. Like you notice the floor looks so clean and shiny. Somebody performed that activity for Krishna. So you feel respectful towards the devotee who did that. And so gradually that need for respect for oneself falls away because you're so busy appreciating there's not room. So that would be a way. And anyway, but be thankful that this has been revealed in your relationship with Krishna. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you for your kind questions.